ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Hello and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm Dr. Ann Zink, your host, to talk to you today about healthcare costs and quality. I learned long ago that the emergency department is where all good public policy comes to fail. And if I was going to care for my patients, I needed to care for larger systems of health. And that's why today I'm diving into a topic that oftentimes brings a lot of heat, and for good reason, healthcare cost and quality. Everyone has a healthcare story. Health is incredibly personal, and healthcare can be incredibly expensive. Patients, providers, policymakers, and the public are all frustrated and oftentimes angry at the system, a person, or a group of people or policy which they see as the problem. But was famously said, healthcare policy is complex, and we can't let that complexity keep us from tackling both small and big problems to improve our health systems. After all, healthy economies are built with healthy people. But how do we get there? What are our obstacles? What are the solutions? And having some understanding of the economics and healthcare factors driving healthcare costs and quality for insurance companies, hospital administrators, physicians, but also everyday Alaskans can help us find solutions. What I find challenging is that healthcare systems that I want as a parent, a patient, and a policymaker are all slightly different. As a policymaker, I want the highest quality for the lowest price. As a patient, I want autonomy and access to healthcare personnel decisions that balance my priorities with my financial responsibilities. But man, as a mom, I want anything and everything that can do to keep my child healthy and well, regardless of cost. And no one system can simultaneously meet all of those needs at once. So today we're kicking off a series of conversations to look at healthcare costs, and quality from a different perspectives. And I'm beyond excited to have two guests with us today. We have economist Jim Ribitzer, economist and co-author of Why Not Better and Cheaper, a book exploring the misalignment incentives of healthcare that contributes to high care and inconsistent quality. And Nat Herz and I switch roles, where he is now the one that I get to interview, an independent journalist who runs the Northern Journal and been diving into health insurance premiums, hikes, and real-world impacts of escalating healthcare expenses on Alaska and other important topics. But as always, we want to make sure that this show is for you, Alaskans, and encourage you to join us. You can always call in at 1-888-353-5752 or from Anchorage, 550-8433, and you can always email us at line1@alaskapublic.org, and we look forward to hearing your conversation and questions. So let's jump in. For the first segment, I wanted to talk a little bit about how we got to this current state of healthcare costs. In this segment, I wanted to talk about the how we have had long distances in healthcare and how Alaska has some of the highest healthcare costs in the nation, and the U.S. has some of the highest healthcare costs in the world. We can talk into lots of different details, but I wanted to give our guests a chance to introduce themselves. Jim, I'll turn it over to you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, how you got here, and why you decided to write this book? Can you hear us okay?
I can hear you.
Great.
I can just find out. I was unmuting myself. So who am I? My name's Jim Ribitzer. I am a professor of economics, management, and public policy at the Questrom School, Questrom School of Business at Boston University. And how did I write the book? I wrote the book with my identical twin brother Bob, who is a healthcare consultant, and he says it's my fault because he was working at a foundation trying to help them figure out how to do, I think, camera imaging of eyes in a better and cheaper way for a low-income population. And he was just having a horrible time of it. And he turned to me and he said, you know, it's a shame nobody can make any money in healthcare by delivering anything cheaper. And I said, wearing my health economist hat, that can't be right. That's ridiculous. And we spent like the next few months talking about it. And at the end of it, I said to him, you know, I think we got a book here. So there's the subject of the book. The book is about a very simple question. Why doesn't healthcare get better and cheaper the way the cell phones we carry around in our pockets do? And the answer we came up with is also simple, which is that it's too easy to make money from low value innovations, and it's too hard to make money from innovations that reduce cost. you ask yourself, well, that's not usually the way we think of innovation working in a dynamic economy. Why does healthcare work that way? And we'll talk about, I'm sure, later today, we identify three fundamental drivers, which are the way the incentives are set up, the way norms and narratives work amongst medical professionals, and also the problem of incumbents, powerful incumbents who are reluctant to innovate. What's novel about our, there's a lot that's wrong with the U.S. healthcare system. It's a centuries-long fix. It's not I got a great idea, I'll fix it tomorrow type problem. But most of the problems and most of the people writing about the health sector focus on three vital signs. They focus on cost. Why does it cost so much to deliver each unit of health service, particularly in the United States? Costs are very high. They focus on quality. We seem to be not getting a lot of gaps in quality and lots of inequities and failures on the quality side in the U.S. healthcare system. And people also talk about access. And by access, they usually mean access to health insurance. And those are the battles that most people have been fighting about. We, in our book, try to introduce a fourth vital sign, and that's innovation. And our claim is that healthcare innovations are not doing what they could. And we're trying to make the argument, try to identify what could be done to encourage innovations for a better and cheaper system than the one we have. And it's a little crazy. You just open the paper any day or turn on your web browser any day and you see lots of medical miracles. And it's a little crazy for two people. I'm an economist, he's a healthcare consultant, who don't spend any time in labs and haven't since we were undergraduate biology majors, and one of us did very badly. It wasn't me. How is it possible that this part of the healthcare system that seems to be producing miracles every day may not be working as well as it could? And that's kind of the aha, the story of our book. Does that answer your question, Ann?
That totally does. There are many things that really resonated about your book, but I really loved how you really focused on innovation and some of the challenges in there and some solutions to it. You know, one of the things that I think is really unique about Alaska is we have such great distances between care. You know, people travel on an average of 175 miles one way to access care. And with such high healthcare costs, there's a lot of incentive for innovation, yet we've kind of been challenged in that space. So now I want to turn to you and have you introduce yourself to the audience and tell us a little bit about why you even report on this topic or how you got into it and some of your thoughts here.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I'm the designated layperson on this panel as a non-doctor, and I think I'm decidedly a non-expert in healthcare, and I think want to keep it that way because it is complicated, and I feel like if I was going to take the time to become a expert, I would probably be at it for, I'd need a medical degree like you. So I think the reason I'm here, I used to work here at Alaska Public Media. I also used to work at the Anchorage Daily News. And a couple of years ago, I left my job and started my own business. And I published like a newsletter and news website. And certainly like probably the biggest thing I was worried about in making that jump and a thing that continues to worry me is I did not have an employer paying for my health insurance anymore, which I knew was going to be a significant expense. And then when I signed up through the federal marketplace, I have to have insurance too. Like I have a not sort of immediately life-threatening heart condition. Like I have an arrhythmia. So it's like, you never know. So I signed up and then, 6 months into having my job or a year into having my new job, it was like I was signing up for the next year. And I was like, I think this is going up by a lot. And I just, got to use my journalistic privileges to email the state director of insurance. And I was like, can you tell me, like, are these rates going up a lot? Like, I haven't read anything about this. I don't know what's going on. And she was like, yeah, here's an analysis. It's going up 18%. And it also went up 18% like the year before. And I was like, I'm not that smart. I'm not a doctor, but it does seem like that's probably news. So I wrote a story about it that was just like, hey, these like marketplace premiums are going up. And fast forward a year And it happened again, another like 18%. And I'm like, I'm just a guy here trying to like, you know, sell $100 memberships to his newsletter and, you know, make everything pencil out. And, the sticker price for my healthcare is like $1,000 a month off the marketplace, and there are federal tax credits available. But the more money you make, actually, the less your tax credits are. So I decided to write it about it again this year, but I kind of made it more of an opinion piece and less of like an straight news piece. And I was like, hey, like, this is still happening. I don't hear anyone talking about it. Like, in my world, I don't hear anyone talking about it in the legislature. I don't really feel like anyone's doing anything about it. Does anyone actually care? And I think some people care, but I think most Alaskans either get their healthcare from a government program or from a large or small group employer. And so they're not aware, but I think all of the sort of dynamics that are fueling the increases in the individual market are actually probably coming to bear also on those other markets. People just don't have quite as good visibility into it because they're not the ones paying for the premium every month. And so, you know, I write about like environment and natural resources. I don't really write about healthcare, but there was such like an outpouring of responses when I wrote that story of people like shaking their fists and saying, you know, like, this resonates with me. I'm going through this and that. And, you know, I still don't think I'm going to do it, but I'm kind of looking at like, is there grant funding to do some more like coverage of healthcare and some of the sort of trends and problems with it in Alaska, and, you know, could expand more upon that, but I'll stop there for now.
Yeah, that's super helpful. And, you know, it's was really helpful for me to just hear some of the thoughts that you had. And I think it's going to take so many more people. As a physician, you know, we're not really trained in, definitely not economics and not in health policy and cost. But I see it regularly impeding my patients' ability to access care. As a physician, we're not employed by our hospital. So I, too, buy my health insurance on healthcare.gov and see the very large costs and very large deductible associated with it and how that's changed pre-ACA and post-ACA. But Jim, help us put this into context just nationally. I know you're not an Alaska healthcare economist expert, but you spend a lot of time thinking about the economy as a whole. You know, in your book, you talk a little bit about healthcare costs as well as rising healthcare costs and kind of the inflation rate and what's happening worldwide versus the United States and what we're seeing. Can you just give us some trends and help to put into context healthcare costs in the U.S. As well as that growth rate nationally?
Sorry, turning this mute on and off it seems to be beyond my technical skills this morning. The healthcare costs are rising. There's two important things to know about sort of just global healthcare. Healthcare is really expensive in the United States. And the easiest way to see that is that the fraction of gross domestic product each year that is spent on healthcare is much higher than in other countries in the world, other rich countries. And what the other thing, which is kind of interesting, is that in every rich country, the proportion of income being spent on healthcare is rising. In other words, it makes sense as people get richer, right, that they're not going to want to buy another canoe. Is that a good Alaska example? I don't know. They're not going to buy a third snowmobile. They're not going to do that, right?
Machine.
They're going to spend money on stuff. They're going to spend money on stuff that is makes their lives better in a more meaningful way because they got a lot of the goods they need, right? And so things that make their life better, like healthcare, it makes sense that richer societies would spend more on healthcare. What's screwy about healthcare is that as the society gets richer, it's not only buying more healthcare, it's spending more of its income on healthcare. So every society, as it gets richer, is spending a bigger and bigger chunk of their income on healthcare. I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't think that's a problem at all. I think that's actually things working the way they should. What's a problem is that the United States spends so much more of its income, annual income each year, on healthcare than other countries. And lots of people have looked into that. And to a first order approximation, it's not because we buy more stuff And it's not because our outcomes are like way better. They're not. And there's huge socioeconomic gradients that are very disturbing in the United States. You know, where poor people just live a lot shorter lives than wealthy people do, or people from privileged socioeconomic status. So it's not that there's people that we're getting a lot more, but we're getting some more. It's not that we're getting a lot, that we're buying more stuff. A lot of it is that the price of the things we buy is much higher. It's a famous economist, Uwe Reinhardt, wrote a paper that whose title I love, said it's the price is stupid. And it's the big problem of costs, the U.S. spending much more than other countries on healthcare has to do with much higher prices. And those higher prices probably have to do, there are lots of causes of them, but probably have a lot to do with monopoly, with market power. And it's not the insurers, or not only the insurers, it's a lot the providers. And the exercise of market power means that you can mark up your prices a lot over costs. And one really important piece of, it's only a piece, but it's one really important piece of the healthcare puzzle problem in the U.S. is that we have incredibly concentrated markets for insurance and markets for providers, hospitals, and so forth. And everybody charges a lot. There's other things, there's lots of other things that we could talk about. But for first approximation, that's why costs are high.
Yeah, appreciate that. And we'll dive into a little bit more with that with Alaska specifically, because it's a kind of a fascinating place thinking about healthcare costs, since we actually have very little consolidation in the marketplace compared to the lower 48, yet costs are high for a whole series of reasons. And so looking forward to kind of exploring that. I do know that I just wanted to remind people that you are listening right now to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're talking about healthcare cost and quality and thinking about how we can make a difference moving forward. You know, one thing I wanted to kind of just also ground our audience in, and, Nat kind of comment a little bit on this, on the private insurance and where people are at. And also, Jim, I think you do a great job in your book talking about, as providers, how many different players there are can be in the market. So if you are an insurer and you're trying to drive down costs, the challenges. So looking at Alaska specifically, about 21% of Alaskans, about 160,000 people, are covered either by Medicaid or by CHIP, which is covered by the Department of Health. Medicare, which is federally run, covers about 9% of residents within the state, and that's overseen federally. So we get a lot of questions about why does Medicare rates are so poor? I can't find a provider. And I know that Alaska Media just recently did a whole segment on why it's hard to find a Medicare, but that's a federally kind of run program. Employee and sponsored insurance covers about 45 to 50% of people in the state. And a lot of those are self-insured programs. So you are a big company and you can self-insure. And those are not really part of the regular regulatory process. So the Division of Insurance has no say over what they do and don't do. There are some federal laws about what insurance, quote unquote, means and what they have to cover. But besides that, there's a lot of flexibility on the way that those programs are run. Our tribal health system is incredibly robust and oftentimes in rural Alaska is the only healthcare system within that region, and provides just this amazing complexity between population health as well as health insurance. And I think some really unique examples that love to dive into, today and further thinking about how we can think about prevention and population health. And then as we were talking a little bit, and both Nat and I purchase insurance on our own, that's the individual group market insurance, and that's what's covered by the Division of Insurance. And you'll find on Line One, Your Health Connection website, we have listed some information from the insurance Division of Insurance for some additional resources. And then there's the state-run ERISA plans, and so these are plans that the state runs that are kind of self-insured. So that's just a brief, high-level rundown of the many different ways that healthcare is covered and insured. There's really six departments within the government, state government, that help to oversee insurance in different ways here in Alaska, because it is quite complex. Jim, before we take a break, we're going to kind of wrap up here and take a break for just a second. But when we come back, I would love to kind of dive into a little bit about how innovations and complexity can help to solve some of these challenges. I really like some of your examples of those examples. So just a reminder for the audience, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're going to get ready to take a quick break. And when we come back, you can join us here and feel free to give us a call at 1-888-353-5752. Or if you're calling from Anchorage, 550-8433 or line1@alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
Welcome back. You're on Line One, Your Health Connection. This is Dr. Ann Zink, your host. And today I'm joined by two great guests, Jim Ribitzer, an economist and author of the book, Why Not Better and Cheaper, as well as Nat Hirst, a reporter and journalist who's helping us to think about AlaskaCare costs. In this segment, we wanted to dive a little bit deeper into why healthcare systems are so entrenched and explore possible reforms. Nationally, we hear a lot about shifting value to value-based care and enforcing price transparency. Sometimes these are very urban-centric proposals, but sometimes they can be very applicable to the state, thinking about things like telehealth, price transparency, and systems-based care, where people may be able to work collectively to try to improve healthcare costs as a whole. I want to encourage Alaskans to join us. You can call in at 1-888-353-5752 or calling from Anchorage, 1-907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org if you have a question for our guests or a perspective you would like to share. But Jim, I kind of wanted to turn back to you. You've talked a lot about how fee-for-service models and incentives really incentivize volume over value, and moving to value-based care could realistically help. And as we talked about previously when we were able to meet before, Alaska really doesn't have value-based care in the same sort of way for a series of different reasons. But help us think about how this could apply in kind of our frontier and rural context and some of the economic policies applying to healthcare market that would be relevant here in Alaska.
Can I also just interject quickly and say I feel like listeners might like benefit from an explanation of like the difference between like fee for service versus value based care, because I feel like that is it's kind of where the magic happens, but it also is like technical sort of.
I love it. Absolutely. And sometimes I get into so much of the solution part of all this that it's great to pull back on that space. So, Jim, maybe I'll hand it over to you to kind of explain the difference between fee-for-service care and value-based care and how you might think about that in terms of its benefit and its risk.
Well, fee-for-service basically says if you deliver a service, you get paid a fixed amount for it. Think of it a little bit like a piece rate. So you go to your doctor, they do a certain procedure on you, and there's a schedule. If it's Medicare, there's a federally fixed schedule, and you get reimbursed. And you can wake up a doctor in the middle of the night and say a procedure, and they'll tell you the code, because that's what they have to think about in order to get reimbursed. Value-based care is the problem that people worry about with fee-for-service is that it doesn't really... You get paid the same whether the quality is high or low. And it creates perhaps, in theory at least, an incentive to do too much stuff, right? That because why not? Somebody else is paying for it. The insurance company is paying for it. And value-based care is really an umbrella term that for a whole set of payment systems that are designed to make the providers and to a certain extent the patients, but primarily the providers, more sensitive to the quality of the care they're giving, and to give them incentives not to do too much stuff, right? Don't give you the extra antibiotic if it's a viral cold or something like that. And so, I'm not Dr. Nair about any of this stuff, right? There are a lot of advantages to fee-for-service, and there are a lot of, and one advantage to fee-for-service is if the fees are set right, everybody gets treated. Right, but you know, it doesn't matter how sick or complicated you are, people have incentive to give you care. There's two problems with the value-based care. One is quality is often hard to measure, really hard to measure, and it could lead people to do screwy things. So the idea is, if you, as a provider, are able to deliver high-quality care at less than the expected amount, you get to keep that difference. That kind of shared savings would create an incentive for everybody, for providers in particular, to be thinking about what's the most cost-effective way I could deliver this service. But that can be, all of these things can mess up. This is why why healthcare is so complicated. Let me give you an example. This is an innovation example, but my brother periodically gives some advice to a high-tech research fund at Stanford University. They get some smart person comes up with an idea, and they want to sort of say, what do you think about it? So, okay, so this smart person, this brilliant mechanical engineer, came up with a way to change the way people walk. His idea was, I can relatively easily change people's gaits so that the reduction in stress on their knees is like losing 20% of their body weight. And the idea was that by doing this, you can then eliminate all kinds of knee replacement and arthritis problems simply by teaching people a behavioral fix, right? So in a system where there's value-based care, this would be like an amazing, interesting, cool innovation. Well, does it happen? So they asked my brother, like, what do you think of this? And he said, man, if it works as advertised, it's amazing. And then they said, is it a good business? And he said, that depends. He said, let's think through the question is, who's going to pay for it? Who's the customer? And he said, let's think about the orthopods. Are they interested? Well, their business is running high throughput knee replacement surgeries. They might be interested in some academic sense, but it won't be high end or to-do list. Right. Well, let's think about the big hospital systems. Would they be interested in that? Well, high turnover knee replacement surgery is an important profit center for almost every big hospital system. So they're kind of, it won't be high on their to-do list either.
My blood pressure is going up.
Yeah, well, it'll get worse before it gets better. Just trust me on that. And then you ask yourself, okay, well, what about the insurers? And the insurers actually would have a powerful interest in this, right? Because they could deliver good knee care at a much lower cost, right? But the insurer's not in the position to kind of tell the physician what to do, right? First off, they don't know enough. Secondly, they lack the social legitimacy. Thirdly, everybody's going to say, what, are you just trying to rip me off so you save some insurance dollars, right? What, like, give me my knee replacement, it's what I need, right? So they have to somehow persuade either the patients or the providers that this is a good idea. Well, the patients basically do what the doctors suggest they should do. So they have to persuade the orthopedic surgeons it's a good idea. How do you do that? How do you solve this problem? Well, in other parts of the economy, there's an easy fix, and it relates to value-based care. We're going to share we're going to save $50,000 on this treatment, or $20,000. We'll give half of it to the orthopod who teaches people to change their gait before they replace the knee, right? That's a great idea, right? But think about it just for a minute. If I'm the orthopod who teaches somebody to change their gait and they postpone by 15 or 20 years their knee replacement, so maybe it doesn't even happen at all, where does that value accrue? that value accrues 15 or 20 years down in the future, right? We have, to your point, Ann, before, an extremely fragmented insurance system, very complicated insurance system that's linked to our labor markets. So people change jobs all the time, and consequently they change insurers. Employers change their insurers all the time. So I'm here at maybe age 50, and my insurer says, I'm going to share half my savings with you to the orthopod if you'll adopt this new thing. But those savings, they can't get a hold of because they're somebody else. They're Medicare savings, right? Because by the time the person's over, not getting their knee replacement, they're on Medicare or they're with another insurance company. That's called a dynamic problem, a time horizon problem. And that time horizon problem bedevils all kinds of innovations about all kinds of chronic treatments, right? Because what you typically do with chronic care is you make an investment now for lifestyle improvements far down the road. But in a very fragmented insurance system of the sort that we have by historical accident, those savings can't be captured and shared. Anyways, so that's one example of the way that the complexity that you talked about the insurance structure and incentives to innovate make it hard to implement a perfectly reasonable value-based innovation, value-improving innovation.
Why is your blood pressure rising? Super helpful. And I'm curious on Nat's response here.
Well, I'm just like, I hate having to hear that our Hippocratic oath-taking, like, doctors and health institutions might be motivated by anything other than the best outcomes for patients, whether that is making sure that you have, you know, a continued viable business model that involves surgeries or, you know, whatever else it is. And I know very acutely that we don't live in a like socialist utopia. My blood pressure didn't go up that much, but I think it's hard to like hear that, you know, the like dynamics that are determining the kind of quality and functioning of our healthcare system are not sort of dictated by like outcomes, but actually sort of dictated by people's bottom lines or the things that sort of serve the status quo, which, you know, I don't think that's a particularly profound observation, but it is, you know, I think definitely like the experience of just a garden variety user of the healthcare system.
But Nat, I think my story led you down the wrong road. Okay. I'm not trying to say that social norms, desire to do right by patients, don't matter in the healthcare system. They matter enormously. And if you spend any time with providers outside of a small handful of misfits, these are extremely motivated people who care enormously about their patients. You're also dealing with modern medicine is very complicated, and it involves, you know, in the United States, approaching 20% of our GDP, $1 in $5. When you have something that complicated spread out over that many people, there's always a question of where people are going to devote their attentions and energies. And that is going to always be shaped in part by their norms, but in part by the incentives, right? And that's not venal. That's kind of, we should talk more about the role of norms, but that's not venal. That's kind of how large complicated systems work.
Yeah. And right? I don't really take it personally. And I think I agree, like my experience in the healthcare system is, you know, generally speaking, like my experience with my individual provider, with some exceptions, is like almost always very good. And I do feel like a lot of the people like working in the space, like are sort of simultaneously like in it for all the right reasons and really dedicated, but also, like you say, sort of have to function, you know, in a like really complex system that requires them sometimes to make compromises that they like really hate. And I am a little interested, and I like, this is not my show, but I do kind of want to put Dr. Zink on the spot a little bit, because I think one thing that I have heard quite a bit, like in the correspondence that I've had with readers after I've like written these stories about healthcare costs in Alaska is like, you know, it is all about these monopolies and it's the greedy doctors that are, you know, making more money up here than they could in other places. And I guess like I am just really curious, like Dr. Zink, to like you work with, you are a provider, you work with a lot of providers, and like, is it? Does Alaska have a problem in that realm of like sort of the amount of money that providers are charging and making here specifically in Alaska any more than that is a problem anywhere else in the system, do you think? Or is the extent that we experience that here, is that just sort of a function mostly of like the sort of incentives and dynamics that Jim is describing nationally?
Yeah, no, I am a provider. You know, I saw patients until 3 a.m. last night, and, you know, I feel like I have 20 stories from last night that fit into this dynamic and these questions. And, you know, I really appreciated in Jim's book the comment about social norms. You know, and I would highlight the fact that social norms have to do with two-way communication and connection. This isn't just how providers act, but it's also the expectation of patients. And, you know, when I get a patient in who's got an illness and they say, I have to go to work, I don't want to be sick, I'm here to you to make me better, and I'm like, you have a viral illness that needs to pass and to clear. I can't do anything. And now there's a multi-$1,000 bill that's going to their insurance company because they wanted a work note to be able to come in. Or a patient that I just recently saw who came in and, you know, says he's totally healthy, never follows up. It turns out he mainly eats pizza and McDonald's and smokes 3 packs a day and has really awful vascular disease that is going to be debilitating for most of his life. And the prevention measures were not kind of set up. So he made personal decisions and there were system incentives that didn't allow him to get in, provide, or allow a challenge. I would say that physicians are very similar across the country, and they're not any different here than they are other places. There's different economic factors that play a role here, but I think that we underestimate how much of our training and our entire system is set up for urban medicine, as well as set up for medicine where you can have a lot of people to provide services and resources. So if I'm a cardiologist, I am used to working with a kidney doctor and a vascular surgeon and other people to be able to provide care. And so to recruit someone up here to say, hey, you're going to work on your own, you're not going to have those services that you're used to. You can't transfer to anywhere. The weather might be bad, and good luck in doing all of that is a real challenge. And we get a lot of providers who come up here and work for a couple years and say, this is really hard medicine. I was never trained to work in a frontier and rural environment. I don't have the resources I need to train in this area, and I'm out. And so recruiting people up here to work in this community and across the state is incredibly challenging. And so the economy does make some factors, and I think in some places does pay more for that. But I think it's more of our fragmented healthcare system, the fact that, you know, I can't see, I mean, I had a patient last night, and she's like, I've been on antibiotics. I can't see at all what antibiotics. I mean, I every shift have some patient who tells me they take 2 white pills. You know how many white pills there are out there? Like, I can't tell what those white pills are. And if I am not choosing the right antibiotic, I'm going to create antibiotic resistance and make problems. And if I am working within a large system like a Kaiser, that it's an insurer and a provider where I can be able to see those data systems, I suddenly am able to not re-image that patient. I'm able to see what antibiotics they are on. I'm able to refer them to a, you know, cardiologist or a nutritionist who's being able to help them. But, you know, in my world, I, again, work at Matsu Regional, I might be sending someone home to their dry cabin on the Deshka, you know, without their epinephrine, which they need for their anaphylaxis, which they came in for, and no way to access it because now all the pharmacies are closed because there's a shortage of pharmacists in the state. So there's all, and so then we keep them in the emergency department overnight. And then, to Jim's point, the costs have now gone up even more. And then to your point, now it's even more expensive to be able to buy that insurance. And so I think there's a lot here in social norms. And I do want to take,
Before we go to social norms, I want to talk about antibiotics for a minute, because it's a way in which social norms and innovation and figuring out what's right and what's good, it's just how involved it is. So Anne was talking about antibiotic use, and she tries, you know, somebody comes in with a viral infection and they're begging for antibiotics because they got to go to work. And she's saying, it's not going to help you. You just got to ride this out, right? So, all right. So let's talk about just for a minute about antibiotics. Let's talk about, but not antibiotics in terms of at Anne's level, which is who am I going to give the pill to? But the question of where the pills come from. So antibiotics are central to modern medicine, right? Nothing good happens without antibiotics. You can't, I mean, from surgery, dental work, cancer treatments, but the bugs evolve, right? So last generation's antibiotics become increasingly less effective as the bacteria evolve resistance. So you would think that the healthcare system would be, because it's so, the need is so urgent, would be regularly developing and implementing new antibiotics. But the fact is, they're not. There's a great crisis worldwide that antibiotics are not being developed. The pipeline is incredibly thin, and they're almost guaranteed money losers for the companies who try to develop them. So why is that? Take a step back even further. I'm sorry this takes you even further from Alaska. We'll come back to Alaska. Take a step back even further. People who develop antibiotics are relying on the incentives that emerge from the patent system. The patent system says, if you come up with something good and useful that people are willing to spend money on, we'll give you a monopoly for a time-limited period of time. You tell us what it is, you let no secrets, you let everybody know what it is, you get 10, 12, 15 years, you charge a monopoly price for that, and then it belongs to the public. And that period of monopoly price, that's a reward that encourages innovation. And it's a kind of cool reward, right? Because it's not some technocrat sitting in NIH, not some gray-bearded engineer saying, oh, this is a cool technical problem. It's people actually willing to use the drug, people like Anne, willing to use the drug that makes the reward for developing that drug large, right? And so it's, you think in that kind of system, of course you'd get a ton of new antibiotics, right? Because they're so useful. Anne would use them. And the fact is, you don't. Why don't you? And that this relates in part to social norms. There is a norm that evolved that Anne hinted at in the profession. It's a very good and powerful norm of wise stewardship, that we know that these antibiotics are really hard to develop. They're really hard to find. They're typically found. They're not that many of them, and we could run out of them. And so the first thing you do when you have a new antibiotic, if you don't use it, you just put it on the shelf, right? Because that's wise stewardship, and that's a very powerful and potent and desirable social norm in the medical profession. It didn't used to be so important, but it's become quite important as the doctors have become hip to this idea that we have to really conserve this very scarce resource. And as a consequence, when you develop a new antibiotic, you don't make any money because you can't sell them, because the doctors doing the right thing don't use them. And so that's an example where there's fixes to that problem, but you have to sort of identify the problem before you can, you know, identify the fixes. But that's a really nice example of where the norms are driving people to do the right thing, and in this particular case, the incentives in the patent system are just working against those norms, and you end up with a problem that we have a worldwide shortage of new antibiotics.
And with that, you are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're going to take a brief break and encourage callers to join us when we come back and talk about some solutions into what we can do about high healthcare costs and quality.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Local sponsors do right by their business and for the community by supporting public media stations. Thank you for considering adding your corporate support. You'll be in good company.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
Hello, you are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. This is your host, Dr. Ann Zink, and we're talking about high healthcare costs and quality with our guests, Nat Hirst, as well as Jim Ribitzer. You can join us by calling 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433, and email us at line1@alaskapublic.org.
We were just leaving off talking about high healthcare costs, social norms, and what we can do about it. In our last segment, I really do want to focus on what are the policy things we can do? What are the individual things that individuals can do? What can patients do? Because I actually think that that is one of the real strengths in this state, is that there aren't a lot of us and we can figure out hard problems together. So Nat, I want to just turn it over to you. Kind of what are your thoughts? What are your questions? What do you want to see?
Oh, man. You know, I do think that like one of the defining features of like being a consumer of healthcare in America, and certainly like for me, is like this feeling of powerlessness. And I think, you know, there are, I think, ways we could talk about it that would make me feel more empowered. I think, you know, one thing that really pops up for me as like just an interesting question. I mean, there were a surprising number of people in the responses to sort of my reporting, people you would not expect, like, you know, more conservative people like in politics and in business, who were kind of like throwing out there, yeah, the system is broken, we need like Medicare for all. And I was like, wow, okay, maybe there's more appetite for that than people think exists. But that feels like a little bit more of like a utopian in the far distant view, like, you know, just knowing where Congress is and stuff like that. One thing that did sound like it was a little bit more of like a live concept, or had been in the past, was actually kind of implementing this more of the kind of value-based care in Alaska than we have now with the fee-for-service model. And I'm curious, like, why don't, like what are some of the sort of versions of value-based care that we could theoretically and plausibly have here in Alaska, and what are the obstacles to us getting those? I feel like you must have a pretty good sense of that from your work.
Yeah, you know, and I'm happy to kind of start, but, you know, I'm also curious, Jim, on kind of what you think in such a fragmented system as a whole. I mean, I think some of the huge challenges to value-based care, and Jim highlights this in his book, is that when you have a small number of people, there can be a lot of variability in individuals. And so you get one person with really high healthcare costs, or you've got a lot of variability in the kind of underlying dynamics of the patients, the health of the patients. It can be hard to connect that value to that individual patient and to be able to look at a population as a whole. The other thing is you need to be able to, if I'm working again in a Kaiser system and all my patients are Kaiser patients, it's much easier to have a value-based system where you say, like, this is what we're paying for and you're gonna be rewarded on it. But if I am an orthopedic surgeon and I'm, you know, contracting with 100 different insurers and one insurer does value-based care, that might only be 10 of my patients. And so the incentive there becomes very limited to be able to make changes towards value-based care. And then if I'm an insurer or I'm the state and I'm thinking about value-based care, I need to make sure I have enough people in that population to make sure that I'm not just paying out an incentive and paying for a fee for service, that I'm actually truly getting an improved value. And to have that, you need enough people in that group. And if you're trying to cover enough people, even in Anchorage, if you just were to look at like Medicaid in Anchorage, and all tribal members can choose to be in or out of a value-based care, the numbers just become really hard to work out in the state. There just aren't enough people to really create enough incentive to be able to get to that value-based care. But Jim, I'm not an economist, but with all of the, you know, distances between space and time, I think that my understanding of what's made it challenging to get to any sort of value-based care within the state has been the diversity of location, the number of self-insured people in the state who are insured by their insurance, where there's no control over that, the ability for tribal members to move in and out of any sort of value-based care option, as well as the limited healthcare capacity. So if you only have one group of orthopedics or one group of cardiologists, it becomes more challenging across that space. Jim, what am I missing from an economic perspective and understanding the state?
I don't think you're missing a lot. I think the challenges you describe are just really daunting, and I think your understanding of them is much deeper and more nuanced than mine. I just have a couple of reactions. First off, value-based care is important. Let's not get hung up on this stuff, right? These are just names for different kinds of payments. And there's a lot of value-based care in Alaska, I imagine, because Medicare Advantage is all value-based. It's all.
We don't actually have any Medicare Advantage, but continue.
You have no Medicare Advantage?
No, we have no Medicare Advantage. But we do have some value-based care. So, I mean, there
it's
are some.
It's about half the country and the rest of the country.
Yeah, welcome to Alaska. It's different up here, we like to say.
All right, I'll take that back.
Okay.
We don't have to go there.
Okay.
I would like at some point to hear why.
Same thing.
Let's talk about distance. A thing that's come up is distances. You've talked about the problem of, like, you got these enormous distances, and the providers are, people are spread out. Providers are not necessarily close to the people they have to spend. And, you know, that's an interesting question. Like, how can a healthcare system evolve to adapt to that? And so, like, let me tell you a story that I can't remember. It's in the book, or we dug it up after we wrote the book. Having to do with hospital at home. Hospital at home is an attempt to give critical care to people at home using telemetry to monitor and training family members to provide different kinds of care. And it's been around forever. There's this guy, Johns Hopkins, whose name I'm currently blanking on, but he's a very interesting and entrepreneurial physician who's been pushing it for years. There's a fair amount of evidence, that not great evidence, but there's a fair amount of evidence. It's no worse for people, that people like it, and that it probably saves a lot of expenditures. It could and potentially save expenditures and additional hospital capacity, because you could treat some of your patients at home through these hospital home type setups. So it's, in that sense, it's kind of a suit telemedicine thing. And so hospital home went nowhere until the COVID crisis. Right. And then all of a sudden, because CMS changed the way it paid for this stuff, you see hospital at home became a very hot thing, at least in the 48. I don't know up in Alaska whether it's hit there yet or not. Anne's laughing, so maybe not. But so you ask yourself the question, why is it that this idea that seemed like a pretty good idea, seems like it filled an important niche, didn't go anywhere until CMS changed, which Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who does the reimbursement for Medicaid for these things, changed its reimbursements in the middle of a once-in-a-century pandemic, right? Like, why wouldn't the private insurers who want their patients to have the care they want at relatively low cost, why didn't they just do it, right? Why wait for Medicaid? And that's a really interesting question, and it gives you a sense of some of the barriers. It relates to the fragmented system, because to make hospital at home work, a hospital has to make a lot of investments, upfront investments in training and equipment and so forth. And those upfront investments create a kind of strategic dilemma, right? Because if I'm in one hospital and I make those investments and another hospital doesn't, they kind of get to benefit, right, of this capacity, or another insurer. If I'm an insurer and the hospital makes the investment and only one insurer pays for it and the other one doesn't, the other insurer gets the benefits of this hospital capacity, even though they're not paying for it. So it's a kind of strategic dilemma. And the way to get around that dilemma is to get all the payers to agree up front that we're going to want to pay the hospital to install this capacity for hospital at home. And the hospitals themselves, the private payers, private insurers weren't able to coordinate themselves adequately for that. But CMS, because it's Medicaid, because it's such a big payer, it can jumpstart a coordinated change amongst payers.
Great.
And I think that kind of jumpstarting is really essential to getting the kind of all kinds of telehealth initiatives, including hospital at home, started in places. And so thinking about jumpstarting and thinking about the federal government playing a role as jumpstarting what private payers will pay for, maybe could help Alaska to innovate a little bit more on these distance treatment.
Along that question, I know we always get exciting right at the end of these shows. We've got now a couple callers who are on the line. One is I wanted to bring in Todd, who wanted to have some questions about innovation for lower costs here from Anchorage. Todd, you're on the line.
Hi, Todd. Yeah, hi. Thanks, guys. I'm really considering a bit of a broader public health sort of perspective, maybe, but I see a possibility and tell me what you think, that efforts to really lower healthcare costs can result in lower costs, but only if people agree to go with the programs. And there will be a group of well-off people who go outside such avenues like insurances and stuff and will receive the most expensive, more high innovative care as opposed to people who can't afford that sort of a private approach receiving the lower cost, usually a little less cutting edge type care. It makes sense. So I appreciate it. I'll let you go.
Great, Todd. Thanks. I appreciate your question. And before we answer, I just want to open the line to Jane from Anchorage, who also had a research question. Jane, you're on the line.
Yeah, I'm going to add one comment to the guest economist. He should really look at the tribal health organizations to explore what does happen when you have kind of a captive population that you will reap the benefits of the upfront investments. A lot of what he's talked about is the idea of how do you do these long-term upfront investments when you can't necessarily capture the savings on the back end. And what aggravates that problem is the financialization of the healthcare industry. So we had the development of pharmaceuticals and drugs before you had major pharmaceutical industries. You had researchers. They worked in universities, or they worked independently or what have you. Taking the financialization out is often portrayed as if, oh, if you don't grant these exclusive patent rights, which then get abused and so forth, you won't have any innovation. We had research and innovation prior to that. It's just incentivized differently and less on a short-term return model. And the same with when health insurance wasn't for profit. You know, making something financialized increases short-term high recoverable profit seeking. It creates its entire own perverse incentives. So it just bothers me that it's frequently presented as if we don't have, you know, for-profit pharmaceutical companies, if we don't have for-profit health insurance, none of this will happen. Well, actually, yeah, it all happened before we had those things.
Jane, thanks so much for joining us and really appreciate the callers calling in. You know, we really have not talked about the tribal health system, which I think is a really interesting, super complex, and very differently structured system that takes into incentives in a very different way from an economics. And I, you know, just want to recognize that that is a huge and very important provider of healthcare and healthcare services in our state, and in many places, the only place for healthcare. And we could do multiple shows and, in fact, have some lined up talking specifically about that. So I appreciate kind of highlighting that topic. You know, we only have a couple minutes left, and I am kind of resonating with Nat's comment about feeling powerlessness. And as a patient, I see that all of the time. And I think one of the things that's really kept me in this state is the opportunity to create change in that. And, you know, in the Mat-Su Valley, we used to, the number one thing that we gave in our emergency department after normal saline was Dilaudid. And it was not uncommon for us to declare someone dead on a regular basis from an opioid overdose. And by working closely with patients, providers, policymakers, and the public before there were incentives to do so, we drastically reduced the amount of opioids out of the emergency department and slowly created an entire system of care where now if I have a patient in the emergency department who wants to get clean and sober 24/7, I can call a peer-to-peer support specialist that's now paid by Medicaid if needed to come meet. So I think there's a lot of hope and options out there, and I really want to encourage Alaskans to take a look at the economics behind this. Why not cheaper and better? I think talks a lot about innovation and social norm, which will make a great difference, and continue to be a part of the conversation. So I really want to thank our guests for joining us. Again, you are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. This is Dr. Ann Zink. We're looking forward to joining you upcoming, and I wanted to make sure that we wanted to thank our producer, Rachel Cassandra, and most importantly, our amazing audio engineer, Chris Hyde, doing an amazing job on the sound and keeping us all running. Thanks so much, and look forward to talking to you next month.
Line 1. One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
Funding for KSDP is made possible in part by the King Cove Corporation, operating the Fleets, Inn Hotel, the Heart Lakes Apartments, and the Last Hook Off Tavern. The King Cove Corporation is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sitkanap to Castle Cape, today northwest winds 20 knots, seas 4 feet. Tonight northwest winds 20 knots, seas 4 feet.